B-Cure Laser is now available in the UK. To get your very special offer right now, just call 0808 501 5122.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, presenter of the show, in which I host experts from the field of integrative medicine for cancer. My guest today is a top oncologist who has been leading the way in the UK in terms of research into and promotion of lifestyle and nutrition for cancer, for the side effects of conventional care, and, most importantly, for the prevention of cancer and other chronic diseases. Professor Robert Thomas is a regular guest on the show and has just published a new book that I'm keen to find out about, so I'm speaking to him at his home in North London over the internet. Welcome back. It's always a pleasure to have you on the Yes to Life show.
Thank you very much, Robin, and thank you for supporting what we're doing.
Excellent. Well, today we're going to be discussing your latest publication, which has the alluring title, How to Live. On the front cover, Professor Carol Sikora, another regular guest on the show, he writes, "This book will dramatically reduce your chances of chronic disease and could literally change your journey through life." So that's a pretty cracking endorsement. So here we have a guide to remaining healthy. One of the first things that immediately strikes you about the book is that it's pretty chunky. It seems that you've got quite a bit to say on this topic.
Yes, it's split up into sort of separate chapters and sort of categories. So hopefully it's not too onerous for people to look at, and many people either read it from start to finish. A lot of people are just dipping in and out, you know, if they want to sort of read about gut health or chronic inflammation, they'll just go straight to those chapters. So yeah, it's but feedback's been good, you know. People say that they you know, they've enjoyed the read. It's not just you know, an educational tome. It's hopefully got some nice humorous anecdotes in there, which makes it a bit easier to read.
It has. I think it's really readable. And I also like to just give a shout to the excellent index in the back. Nothing worse than a book like this that has a crap index. So important when you want to find something again or just look up one particular thing. Yeah. So that's really good.
Yeah, that was at the 11th hour, the publishers made it very clear they wanted a reference, which you know, was quite hard work actually, but actually made it better, because you had to go over every single statement and make sure you had two or three reliable references to support it. So I think it does add to it.
Yeah, it certainly does. It gives substance to a book to have references as well, doesn't it? So early on in the book, one innocent-looking statement in the midst of the introduction points clearly to how unusual you are as a senior oncologist. You say, when talking about the long-term effects of cancer, my mission has always been to treat as many of these conditions as possible by using natural strategies. So this is hopefully becoming less exceptional as time goes on, but certainly when I first met you the best part of a decade ago, you were completely unique amongst UK oncologists in this aim. So I'm just interested, what prompted you to have such an innovative outlook?
Well, yes. I mean, I think as you just, there's a number of points there. First of all, there are more physicians, oncologists getting interested in lifestyle and integrative medicine, actually. And it's really pleasing to see conferences now having quite large sections on nutrition, diet, supplements. So, yeah, it is changing.
Right.
It's slower than we both like, but it is changing for the better. I mean, what prompted me? I was always interested in trying to find ways that patients can empower themselves to share the decision-making process in what drugs they should and shouldn't have, what, you know, whether they should have radiotherapy or surgery. So, you know, 15 years ago, a lot of that research we did was all about how to get the message over and how to help patients understand their quite complex options. And that's sort of pretty mundane now. I mean, organizations like Macmillan are producing good leaflets, and videos and online resources like yourself in Yesterlife. So it was a natural progression from there to go on to other things which patients are interested in. You know, I've got the honour of treating at least 20 or 30 patients a day. I have a busy NHS practice, and I hear from them, you know, they're saying, I was told not to exercise, I was told not to do this, I was told to eat what I liked. And there was a massive shortage or in understanding on a routine cold face sort of situation. And, you know, we're here to try to improve patients' lot and improve their outcomes and make them feel more comfortable with their treatment options. So it was, to me, it just seemed a natural progression to move into things patients wanted to hear about and wanted to discuss.
Right, right. I love the way actually you contrasted trying to address these kind of side effects and various circumstances with drugs, and you used a children's nursery rhyme to illustrate the effect of trying to do it that way. Maybe you'd elaborate for our listeners.
Yes, I mean, you know, I've got some small kids, and we sometimes read nursery rhymes. And as you may know, a lot of nursery rhymes are based on, you know, sort of truth, like Ring a Ring of Roses is supposed to be related to the plague.
Yes.
And the woman who swallowed a fly, and then she swallowed a spider to eat the fly, then a bird to eat the spider. And it is a bit like that in medicine. You know, you start someone on a statin, you know, they get... you know, because their cholesterol is a bit high, they then get sort of, you know, joint pains. So you then give them a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. They then get indigestion. So they're then given anti-indigestion medication. You know, then their gut health gets damaged because of the, you know, anti-indigestion treatment. So then you have to give them, you know, laxatives. And it just goes on and on and on. So, a lot of patients come in with a list of 10 or 12 drugs, which many feel is just normal. You know, it's, so they say, oh, these are just the normal drugs, doctor. And, you know, they're not normal, you know, and 90% of these drugs could be stopped, in my opinion, if there was a change in lifestyle, which was sort of determined and longer term.
Well, I think that's a very important message indeed. I think you're right. Certainly within kind of my parents' generation, I think it had become completely normal to expect that beyond a certain age, at least, you would be on, a dozen drugs. It's just amazing. And most of those, as you say, seem to be dealing with the side effects of some of the other ones. So it's like, you're on a hiding to nothing in the end. But so it's very good to hear you say that, because I think, you know, there is a general recognition that polypharmacy, as it's called, doesn't really work.
I mean, I'm sure they're all sort of contrary. I mean, I had some, you know, personal experience. I had some pains about 15 years ago. I took some non-steroidals. I did actually run a marathon, so I think there was an issue with concentrating them a bit. My blood pressure went up, and I went to the doctor. He said, no, you need to start tablets. I said, there's no way. I mean, I'm going to, you know, so I just started taking, you know, did some research of our own, looked around, spoke to nutritionists, and just at the time just took some extra beetroot and extra celery, cut down a bit on the salt. Within 3 months, it's completely normal. It's been normal since. Now, how many people have been to the doctor with the same story, who've been put on tablets the rest of their lives?
Yeah.
So not only is it bad for them, they're getting side effects of those. You know, it adds to the burden of disease nationally. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it costs money for you and I. You know, it costs money for the state, which is, and you don't need to spend.
Wasted money. Yeah. Well, important message. So you're an oncologist, and everything you've written to date has been pretty squarely aimed at people with cancer. How to Live, however, seems to target chronic disease in general and to be aimed at the entire population. So what's driven this jump from one condition to many?
I mean, well, first of all, before oncology, most oncologists have trained as general physicians. So we like to call ourselves general physicians. A lot, but probably more recently, a lot of the oncology drugs are called biological agents or immune therapies. which have a very different profile of side effects than, say, routine chemotherapy or radiotherapy. So they're causing things like high blood pressure, raised cholesterol, lung disease, dementia, obesity, joint pains, and, you know, even things like Parkinson's, etc. So oncologists are actually having to sort of start dealing with those conditions, because when we talk to a patient about the side effects, say, of a certain biological agent, you might say, well, you know, you've got an increased chance of weight gain and dementia later on. We need to sort of understand those conditions, which we did have a certain baseline understanding, but we really need to understand them now and understand strategies to reduce these side effects, which might come on 5 or 10 years later. So I think most oncologists are fairly much in a good position to be dealing with chronic diseases, because the things I've just mentioned are now the biggest killers in the world. I mean, 90% of diseases in the Western world are of diseases which go on to be fatal are in that domain. They're chronic diseases, of which cancer is in itself a chronic disease. So, you know, just in a nutshell, sort of heart disease, diabetes, obesity, dementia, they're the top killers now. So it's I think it's perfectly appropriate for us to start exploring strategies to reduce these. And on top of that, I mean, I've always been interested in exercise. As you know, I'm an exercise, a professor of exercise and biological science in the local university. You know, it's an interesting field, and it's enjoyable to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just interested that as time goes on, it seems to be that more and more the seemingly disparate selection of chronic diseases seem to be finding out there's quite a bit in common between them, in fact, that they share many of the same roots. And hence, things like lifestyle approaches can be just as good for one as for another. Is that part of what's led you to broaden your reach here?
Absolutely. I mean, the fundamental core problems are common to all diseases. In fact, that was a slight issue when you're writing the book, even though you wanted it to flow from start to finish, you wanted each chapter to be self-standing. So, you know, there was a little bit of repetition. So I've tried to sort of point out the different things. So, you know, so for blood pressure, for example, I've already mentioned things like nitrate-rich foods, like beetroot, celery, without going over the whole thing. But the core things like increased chronic inflammation, poor gut health, a diet low in polyphenols and phytochemicals, which are the natural chemicals in food, too many pollutants in our environment and food, they sort of pretty much cover those 90% of chronic diseases. So when you're helping, you know, diabetes, you're also helping arthritis, and you're also helping high blood pressure.
Right. So would you say, though, that, you know, given that your established audience is people with cancer, would you say this book is wholly relevant to them nonetheless, even though it's aimed at the whole population?
Yes, I mean, I've got another book, as you know, Keep Healthy After Cancer, which is a bit more specific to cancer, I have to say. But with the changing landscape of treatments, I think, yes, this is probably, you know, this is very relevant to patients with cancer now and people who've gone through cancer wanting to reduce the risk of chronic diseases, which is higher in cancer survivors as well. Right. So yes, yeah. I think it does cover all bases there.
Okay. So you put a subject that seems to be in the obsession of scientific research for the last few decades right at the start of the book, genetics. It's a refreshingly short and straightforward section. My sense is that you were seeking to put things in perspective at the outset there. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, part of the planning of the book was a bit tricky, and the publishers really had, I mean, a nice thing of doing it with the publishers, they can guide you because they've got years of experience. And what you didn't want to do is start off the book with pretty heavy going stuff, like explaining what genetics is, explaining, you know, how the immune system works. So, you know, some people, we have had feedback, it's a bit heavy at the beginning, but most people, they say they were grateful for it, because a lot of people just explain things in book, you need to do this, you need to do that. But in my experience, if you really, if people really understand the fundamentals of why they're doing things, they're more likely to do them and continue to do them in the long term. And a lot of the things in diet and lifestyle is, you know, is relates to the genes we're born with, our biological processes, and how, when we do eat something or do something which isn't so good, how these biological processes change. And then when they change, how these affect disease. So I think it's important. It's a bit like characters in a book. You know, sometimes you read a book and the first couple of chapters are a bit slow, but you're introducing the characters. So later on, when we refer to immunity or chronic inflammation, people understand what that means, and they then understand it better as they go through the book. But I hope it's not too technical for some. I think, well, what do you think? Do you think the balance is about right?
I put myself as quite a lay reader. I never delve deep into science. I always get the general picture of what's going on is my aim. And I thought it was very readable. So I think it's great. And I think also it does the job of setting, you know, the idea still persists that genes are kind of like, well, they are handed down from God. That's your lot, mate. And that you just have to put up with it. But of course, your book is about epigenetics, basically, about the way in which you can influence your own genes. And it kind of puts that idea into perspective. It's true to a slight extent, but only a bit, you know, and in general, the most important thing is what you can do to influence that.
Yeah, I mean, and people who, don't forget, this is not a information leaflet you're giving to all patients. This is a book written for people who choose to buy it.
Yes.
So generally speaking, you know, there's a level of interest already there. And, you know, people hear these terms, you know, they hear, you know, and a lot of the terms are just used very loosely in the press. You know, people call, say, boost immunity, and they use the term antioxidant far too liberally. And I think it's important to explain that, you know, you're not boosting the immunity by doing something. In fact, too high an immunity is a problem. You know, you get asthma, you get allergic to things. So it's not about boosting it or increasing, it's about enhancing and making things work better.
Yeah.
And, you know, people get the immunity mixed up with oxidative stress. They are two completely separate things. Right. Many people don't understand, including myself before I started, you know, they say, well, don't we need inflammation? You know, they're saying one minute you're saying we need an immunity, then you're saying that there's too much. So it tries to describe, you know, how too little immunity is bad, an efficient immunity is great, and too high and a non-specific sort of inappropriate immunity is also very bad. And I hope, you know, that then when people understand that, they sort of can understand the terms and read other literature as well as my own with a better sort of empowerment.
No, it's very important, very important. Okay, so... here we have, this is a diet and lifestyle book. And another thing that's immediately apparent is that the lion's share of the information you've got to pass on, more than half of its 400 plus pages, is actually about food. Would you say this is because we have more information about the effects of food, or because it's the most important factor affecting our health?
Well, yes. I mean, it's something we do every day. I think exercise is really important, and body weight, and also environmental chemicals. But I think what you can do to change yourself, I think food is pretty much up there as number one.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's important to know that. So you cover the waterfront here. As I said, more than half the book is given over to food. It's nothing if not comprehensive, including all the important food and food groups, evaluating the evidence, laying out the biochemistry, and, if you'll excuse the pun, serving it all up in a very digestible format. Okay, so there's a whole wealth of information here, and you've got something to say about most of the well-known dietary interventions and their merits or deficiencies. I wanted to ask you about one of my own personal touchstones, food provenance. I've come to feel that while what food we eat may be important, what has been done to it may generally matter more. So I'm very picky about organic standards, lack of processing and additives. Just interested to hear what you think about this.
And I totally agree. I mean, there was an article in New Scientist a few years ago, you know, had a broccoli and it had a piece of rock inside it, like, industrial farming is trying to sort of reduce diversity, increase, sugars within foods and make them look beautiful in Waitrose, but are they doing us any good? So I totally agree with you. And I get asked the question, no doubt you do as well, about organic. I do try and buy organic, even if it's just for an environmental benefit. But there's lots of other benefits of organic. They don't use GM. They don't use monosodium glutamate. We know that organic food has more polyphenols and phytochemicals, which are the natural chemicals within foods which give it its color, a taste and smell. So that probably explains why it probably tastes a bit better and look better. Well, it may not look like a beautiful regular broccoli stem. It might look a bit deformed, but it certainly tastes better. The trouble is that the people who argue against organic then say, yeah, but there's no double-blind randomized trials to show it improves health, which is true. There are few trials which show it's improved health. But when we know it's better for the environment, it's got more natural chemicals, which we know are healthy, more vitamins and minerals, you sort of think, you know, it has to be good for you. And the default would be to eat more sort of that sort of food. And if someone, you know, in 10 years time does a study which says it doesn't make any difference, well, we can always go back at that point.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of arena in which common sense goes an awful long way, I think. This sort of science of the bleeding obvious, as I sometimes call it, is all very well, having to prove everything. But actually, food without toxic chemicals or, which hasn't been bred to have special color or something, is far more likely to be good for you. I mean, you know, that is just common sense. But
at the end of the day, they also have less pesticides and herbicides, which we do know have, you know, phytoestrogenic and sort of maybe carcinogenic or pro-inflammatory consequences. Yeah. I agree with you. It's a common sense, but it's not just about the, you know, whether it's organic or not. It's, you know, whether it's been heated or boiled to smithereens, whether it's been baked to very high temperatures in the oven. I'm particularly interested in the way meat is cooked. I'm not saying you shouldn't eat meat. In fact, the evidence suggests maybe two or three times a week is probably good for you. But you don't have to eat meat. But the way we cook it, you know, we fry it. It's got the oil is dripping onto a very high plate. It's immediately turned into carcinogens. The nitrates are converted into acrylamides, which are then increase the risk of stomach and pancreatic cancer. So it's how you cook it as well is important, and what you eat it with, combining foods, you know, making sure there's lots of vegetables and things on the same plate at all times.
Mm. There's a lot to know, isn't there? It's quite an education, really, once you start digging into this stuff. But it's very good. It's excellent to feel like you're doing the very best you can to be as healthy as you can. It's a great way to live.
And it's not meant to be making people feel guilty about eating. I mean, what it's saying is you can eat meat and you can eat chips and you can eat this and that, but just make sure you combine it with, I just had some fish and chips for lunch, you know, but I poured, I had some lovely chili powder on the chips.
Right.
I cut the batter off the fish and I made sure I had a bit of salad with it. And I'll be going for a run later, so I don't need to worry about the calories. But, you know, right. When you see people eating the batter of the fish are having no vegetables with it, not even pepper or any herbs, and then washing that down with a can of sugary drink. Yeah. You know, they've just done everything bad. There's no balance in there at all.
No. Right. Yeah. Okay, well, this is where a bit of learning goes a long way, and your book, of course, is packed with it. So, in amongst the discussion on diet, you tackle the thorny issue of processed sugar and its potential as a driver of chronic disease, including cancer. As you point out, there's still resistance to this concept, but it seems that your position is kind of wake up and look at the facts. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, there's surprising resistance, which is which I don't really understand. I mean, whenever I give a talk, there's always some dietitian who stands up and says there's no evidence for what you just said. So I have done an evidence review and posted it on my blog, which is blog.cancernet.co.uk, or it was published in, I think, Icon magazine. And there's, you know, there's lots of evidence that people who eat more processed sugar have a higher incidence of chronic disease and cancer and poor gut health. And then as a consequence, they've got more risk of diabetes and then leads to other complications. So I don't understand when people say there's no evidence. There's lots of evidence, and that's been summarized very briefly in the book. And then when you try to do initiatives like we did in Bedford Hospital last year, we replaced sugary snacks in the workplace and replaced them with fruit and nuts. Mm. And we evaluated happiness scale and weight. And there was a highly significant improvement in happiness scores. Staff were less fatigued. They were more motivated and they'd lost weight. And they really embraced it.
Wow.
And that paper was published last Thursday, in fact.
Excellent.
Which was good. I'm glad it was published. But when I went to the hospital, yeah, I said, can you promote this paper? Because I think it's really important and I think other hospitals could learn from it. They refused to do it. They said that, it gave a slightly negative message that patients should be able to give nurses cakes and sweets every day. I couldn't believe it. You know, I just thought 20 years ago there was smoking in nursing
stations,
and now you know it's quite obvious that we should not be, you know, patients should not be coming into a cancer unit or a diabetes unit and see the nursing station or the reception desk piled with sweets and chocolates and cakes.
Right.
But I've been told that has to be regarded as a norm, and I'm being a bit outside the box suggesting otherwise, which I'm finding a bit flabbergasting, to be honest.
Well, I'm not surprised. Well, I mean, you're taking a proper scientific approach to it, that's why, and the science says, actually, this is not a good thing to do. So when you think you're being kind to somebody, you're actually encouraging them to be unhealthy, which is not that kind, really. And so it's not really
yes,
much sense.
I mean, and also around the country, people are donating to patients on chemotherapy bags with chocolates and sweets.
Yeah.
And whenever I confiscate them, I'm always seen to be the bad guy, you know. And I'm trying to do is, patients who are on chemo would have increased risk of dental caries, increased risk of diabetes, weight gain, poor gut health. So I'm trying to encourage them to do well. And I do sometimes feel like I'm getting lack of support from the NHS as a whole, not from organisations like yourself. Saying that, there is an initiative from the NHS to reduce sugar, and hospitals actually get judged for it on their quality commissioning.
Right.
So I did try to point that out, but then they're so regimented, so they judge from the amount of sugar sold within a hospital,
right?
Not the amount of sugar consumed, which of course is their overall aim.
Yeah.
Anyway. I hope that's going to change.
Yeah, roll on change in that area for sure. Yeah, it seems like this is one of those kind of juggernaut situations where the whole country's got behind the sort of the great low fat thing that went on since the 1960s or something, and they've been ramping up the sugar in everything relentlessly at the same time without everybody noticing, and turning that juggernaut around is just, it takes a lot, it really does.
It does. But, you know, I remember, you know, I sound, as I get older, I just sound like a real grumpy old man. It's really hard. But, you know, I went to Waitrose and Tesco's a few years ago. I wrote to them and said, listen, why can you only get soya milk with sugar in it?
Right.
You know, clearly people who, you know, choose to, you know, not have too much dairy, they're probably a bit more self-health conscious. The answer was that's what people want. And it's great to see now, pure through commercial and consumer change, people were buying sugar-free, you know, soya milk or almond milk and things. And now you hardly see the stuff with sugar in.
Right.
So I think supermarkets are a little bit slow to understand what people want, yeah. Actually. They sort of think. And half the time, it's because you go to the supermarket and you can't get anything without sugar in, so you have to buy something.
Yes.
They're forcing us to buy it. But if you give even the free-from sections, if you look carefully, they're full of wheat and they're full of sugar.
Right. Well, they could actually, I mean, instead of being businesses that are entirely bowing down to the wishes of the public as they see it, they could also take a lead and be a little, try and be a bit educational as well. At the same time, if they like, you know, they can have a section which is for people who are interested in what might be really good and, you know, and actually use that as a sales point. I mean, you know, I just a moment, but... So
well, Tesco, fair play to Tesco, they have stocked my book, so I have to support.
Yeah, you've got to support nice things about Tesco. Yeah, right, very good.
And they do actually have quite a good organic section, fair play. They're probably better than most, I think.
I think it's great that supermarkets have that kind of stuff in them these days. That's brilliant, yeah. So moving on to the habits and lifestyle section of your book, that's similarly inclusive. It covers everything from environmental hazards to sleep, from cannabis to exercise. And it's really great to see that you've got a section on mental health. I think, you know, for far too long, mental health has been kind of boxed away, divorced from physical health. And the idea that there could be any connection between, say, you know, our mood and outlook and what we eat or whether we exercise, it was just considered ludicrous, let alone there could be any direct connection between Alzheimer's and cancer, say. But so really pleased to see that. I mean, you know, what drove you to put that section in there? What was your aim?
Well, a number of things. I mean, you know, mental health is still a physical condition. I mean, most of the... a lot of the evidence is, you know, if you have poor gut health, for example, that puts you into a low mood with fatigue, which then, you know, if persistent can lead to depression. We know that people who are depressed after heart disease, after cancer treatments, they have a higher relapse rate. So, you know, it's not only just good to address it because being in a bad mood or being depressed or anxious is troublesome in itself, it leads to other conditions. You know, it leads to poor lifestyle choices. It leads to higher inflammation in itself. We know that depression can have a physical effect on gut health, you know, independent of all other things. So, yeah, it's an integral part of a healthy lifestyle. You know, mind and body is one.
Mm. Well, it's so good to hear you saying that. And, you know, as you point out there, it's a sort of two-way street, isn't it? Is that the physical can affect the mind, you know, what kind of state your body's in. But also, as you just said, the other way as well, if you actually get in a low mood, it starts to depress things in your biochemistry, which is, in some ways, it's quite obvious, but actually we've taken an awful long time as a race to get to understanding this or beginning to understand it as we are now.
And it always, I did psychiatry when I was younger and, you know, had to go to the psychiatric wards. And it always fascinated me why nobody was addressing, you know, exercise, smoking, diet. And many patients who end up in psychiatric wards are chain smoking. They're just walking, sitting around, you know, eating poor quality hospital food. I'm thinking, well, you know, how many of those would have been helped by a you know, determined lifestyle intervention? I would probably say 90%.
I think you might be right. Yeah. I mean, you can actually feel straight away that the connection, you know, just I'm talking from my own experience, if you get a bit down and a bit hopeless feeling, then immediately it doesn't really matter what you eat, you know, or what you do in the same way, you know, the same sort of looking towards a positive future is not there, that would kind of encourage you to do things which make you feel good.
Yes. But there's also a section on, you know, trying to, like, mindfulness, accepting that we are going to feel nervous from time to time. Right. We are going to feel depressed from time to time, and sort of embrace it in a way as human nature. You know, we can't all get up and do backflips out of our bed and, you know, eat a sort of a quinoa burger while sort of looking, you know, running across the beach. That is not a real world, you know, but we are going to feel down from time to time, but embrace it as a normal part of being a normal human being.
Well, also very important, you're absolutely right. We do have to make room for the ups and downs of life, because it is challenging for all of us at times, particularly, I mean, you know, a lot of people are challenged right now with the current situation, aren't they?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, the public has, I believe, become increasingly thick-skinned about dietary and lifestyle information due to the numbing effects of the Daily Mail syndrome, the kind of flip-flop, one day it's going to kill you and the next you need it to save your life headlines. There's a sort of herd immunity and general cynicism has built up in response to this relentless barrage of misinformation. So your book, coming from a top medic, summarizing genuinely useful information and highlighting that we are victims neither of our genes nor the advertising industry, I'd say is sorely needed. Little bit of a wishful thinking here. If the government were to adopt How to Live as their handbook for health policy planning, if they were to begin changing the environment, which, as you say, prioritizes pills over Pilates, how much effect do you think this might have on the health of the UK?
In a utopian world where we're taught from school and encouraged, and all supermarkets were on board, and, you know, they didn't have foods which are twice the price, which are healthier than unhealthy food, you know, all those things, I think a significant benefit. I think it's very likely that majority of people will enter the, you know, in 80 years plus, you know, not on medication and feeling, you know, generally well. We're all going to die of something. Sure. So I'm not saying, in fact, that's why the title of the book is How to Live, not How Not to Die. Mm-hmm. But it's about how to live, you know, well, how to live as best as you can with the genes you've been born with. Right. I would say at least half cancers wouldn't exist. So half the oncologists would be out of a job.
A big number, that is.
I think the incidence of diabetes and obesity, which is now, and when we talk about COVID as a pandemic, it is a bigger pandemic. I mean, the incidence of obesity is, you know, tripled in the last 20 years. Diabetes, you know, every 5 or 6 years, there's millions more people in Western countries suffering that from disease. Mm. I think it would probably reduce by about 80% the incidence of type 2 diabetes and all the knock-on consequences of that. So I think it's a major influence. The reason why I think governments don't do it is it's sometimes hard to change people. Mm. So they have done health initiatives. You know, they're not ignoring this issue, but they'll spend a lot of money on advertising and things. And, you know, unfortunately, the results of change are not that good. So we need to find better ways to get the message over.
Right. So, I mean, from your experience, I mean, you do have lifestyle consultations with your patients, and you're trying to encourage change in that direction. What have you found that works the best?
Well, there's a slight difference when people coming to me who, know they're going to get a lifestyle type consultation, or people on, say, active surveillance for prostate cancer, where they, you know, I might get to see them 4 or 5 times, and they are aware that these things could reduce the risk of having an operation or radiotherapy, to comparing that against the general public, it's much harder to change the views of the general public than people who've sort of had a teachable moment or a scare. But it's important to sort of make sure everyone in the pathway is singing from the same hymn sheet. So, the nurses, the specialist nurses, the surgeons, the radiotherapists, the radiologists are all, you're all saying the same message. And what we're trying to do in Bedford and Cambridge is sort of even recruiting pharmacists, for example, who have got a lifestyle-y type interest.
Wow.
And, giving lots of internal talks to make sure you get people on board. But even so, it's hard. You know, even in places like Cambridge, there's 20 oncologists now. I'd say probably about 5 or 6 are interested in lifestyle, and the others think it's nothing to do with them and they shouldn't get involved in it. So, it is hard to make the change. Give them motivation, give them the evidence, explain why lifestyle is important. Try to get them to understand what benefits they're going to get. They'll be on less medication. They'll be, in a better mood. They'll be able to move around more. So it's a slow but steady process.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think from my own experience, I would agree with that. I mean, doing what I do, I've had a long, intense education, basically, spending innumerable hours listening to experts talking about things and reading things. And it definitely has changed me, but it hasn't been overnight. You're right. It takes time. And some things that start off thinking, that's ridiculous, doesn't really matter. A few years later, I might say quite a different thing about it, that actually I would never do that, And so that's the effect of the education. So I think you're right. Education is key.
And to get the facts, because, with the book, although a lot of it is on literature searches and seeing what other people have published across the world, there are still enormous gaps in the knowledge. Does it matter? Is weight the issue, or is it the muscle to fat ratio which is the issue? How exactly can you improve gut health? There's gaps in the knowledge. So that what makes me different to other people is that I do lead a research unit which has published over 100 papers. Yes. And those projects have been directed by gaps in knowledge. So either what patients are asking, or we can't find an answer. Or, a good example is when a few years ago, someone from Indianapolis managed to publish a paper saying tea was bad for you. It wasn't actually a very good paper because they branded tea with a whole lot of other things which are actually quite harmful. But the press just homed in on tea. So all the headlines were tea causes cancer. So obviously I couldn't just say that he's wrong. So we had to do a similar study with 155,000 people, which we followed for 12 years and just looked at tea intake and correlated that against chronic disease and cancer. Okay. And not surprisingly, if you specifically look at tea, there was an actual anti-cancer benefit. Right. So we could then publish that, which we did in ASCO last year, and then go to the press and say, look, we're not just, arguing this funk, we're proving that this is now a fact. Tea is good for you, drink it. And it's a great British institution as well. So a lot of the things in the books, have been proven by our own studies. Disappointingly, of course, when we then approached the press about that, there was lukewarm interest. They were much more interested in promoting, a negative story about tea because it's something we all love.
Yeah, right. The press is the press and will ever be, I think. But anyway, I'm glad you didn't, as a Briton, you didn't take that lying down.
Yes.
Fought back on our established drink. So I just wanted to come back to something you mentioned right at the beginning of the talk, which I was incredibly pleased to see in the book. It could have all been about just the sort of medical side, if you like, of lifestyle interventions and how good they are for us. But actually, you underline the direct connection between our health and the health of our environment. So this is a much bigger picture, and it's a really key message for the human race at this time, I think. We need to take this on board as a fact and learn from it pretty quick, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, that was something the publishers didn't want me. You know, they took, actually, there was another two chapters on that, which was taken out by the publishers because they say it was already a bit long. I suppose they had a point. But, you know, we all know the argument about excess and meat production. It's, you know, wasting land, which could be used for crops, which is better to feed humanity. It's using up water resources. You know, it's creating global warming and gases and things. But, you know, things like sugar, you know, people don't think that sugar is really, it's really bad for the environment. You know, you're growing cash crops by knocking down rainforests. You then, if that's not bad enough, you often with sugarcane, you're burning it in the farming process. So you're billowing out fumes into the atmosphere. You're then shipping it around the world, you know, from tropical countries to the West. You know, there's an enormous humanitarian issue with these things. Mm. You know, we know that the plastics we're all using in packaging and plastic bags, and also the pesticides and herbicides, they have quite considerable estrogenic effects. So that's going to affect our fertility, increase the risk of estrogen-dependent tumors, and, you know, reduce libido. So, you know, this is a serious issue. In the years to come, you'll have, you know, men with low libidos, low sperm counts, you know, and if you know, it sounds like a Woody Allen film, you know, there'll be nobody left to increase the population.
These are major issues. So anyway, maybe there's a case for packaging up your orphaned chapters into a little booklet, separate item. Okay, so big congratulations to you on pulling the book together. I would see it as a very accessible resource. It's all delivered with your characteristic wry sense of humour, which makes it very readable. But I know from personal experience what immense task books can be. So, yeah, huge congratulations on a fantastic resource for people. And thanks for coming on today to tell us about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. We could talk for hours. One thing we didn't mention, Robin, is, you know, the COVID story. I hope you know, it's published in September, so I managed to get a little bit about how we can protect ourselves from COVID, how we can improve our immunity and reduce excess oxidative stress. So I think it's relevant to, you know, what's going on at the moment, and it's relevant for, you know, what's going to be in our lives over the next 20 years. So I appreciate your support, and I hope people enjoy reading it.
Thank you.
Cheers. See you, Robin. Bye-bye.
Professor Thomas has been chipping away at mainstream views in oncology for a decade or so, and is finally starting to have an impact. This new book should prove another important step in changing attitudes both amongst the public and, importantly, professionals. A reminder to get the Christmas season off to a good start by joining in the Yes to Life online dinner on December the 10th. Go to yestolife.org.uk for details and to book. It's going to be ridiculously good fun, and the entertainment is going to be spectacular. Thanks for joining me today. I'll be back at the same time next week to introduce another guest from the world of integrative medicine for cancer here on the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.